So I'm going to talk about some work that we recently did on a project looking at the effect of a brief exposure window to secondhand tobacco smoke on pulmonary function. And so one of the key roles that I had in that project was really figuring out how we were going to handle the exposure assessment process with that project. And let me start with my disclosure. I don't have any relationships to disclose on that. So secondhand tobacco smoke is a combination of mainstream and sidestream smoke. So your mainstream smoke being your exhaled smoke and sidestream smoke being the smoke coming off the end of a smoldering cigarette. And there's a, being public health professionals, you're probably all very familiar with the wide range of health effects from exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke. And they range from cancer to a spectrum of cardiovascular and respiratory health effects. And I got started on this work on secondhand tobacco smoke back in 2006 when the state of Louisiana passed the Smoke-Free Air Act. And there were well under 10 states that had statewide smoking restrictions at that time. And one of the things we wanted to set out to do was to document the effectiveness of the legislation once it went into effect. And the law did a couple things. It prohibited smoking in most public places and workplaces, but it did leave some areas exempt, including standalone bars and casinos, and that remains true to this day. Although one other part of the law was that it removed preemption, so it made it, and it, localities could implement their own ordinances and go completely smoke-free if they'd like. And before that law was passed, that would have been impossible. So some past research. So initially, when we were doing some of this research, you know, when you go out and you investigate, you say, well, if you're going to go measure air pollution in a smoky area compared to areas where there isn't smoking, you know, it's not really surprising that you're going to find quite a big difference there. And I'm going to discuss a little bit, you know, the relevance of the different categories here. But this was a study in Baton Rouge. We're looking at bars and casinos, comparing to smoke-free restaurants and outdoor air. And, you know, we've seen in our studies there's about a 20-fold difference in the exposure markers that we measure in smoking areas versus non-smoking areas. And when you look at them in terms of what portion of these facilities had, you know, really high levels of tobacco smoke, It was pretty serious when you compare it to the EPA's air quality index. And I'll show a little bit later in the talk, I'll show the different categories related to that. So for this study, our overall research question was, what happens if you have healthy non-smokers who go and spend a brief amount of time in a smoking environment? What happens to their lung function after a few hours in that environment? So our study design is that we recruited a sample of adults 21 to 34, and we were able to establish a relationship with the smoking pub in New Orleans, and they had a really nice setup. They had kind of a prep kitchen area, which was a separate building right next door to the bar. So we had a smoke-free area and the smoking area. So we could do our baseline pulmonary function and exposure measurements in the smoke-free area, escort the participants they spend 3 hours in the bar, and there's a restaurant too, they serve food, and then after the 3 hour duration, come back into which we call the lab, the prep kitchen area, and spend 2 hours. Then we were looking to see if you would have baseline pulmonary function level, which we measure with the standard pulmonary function test, would you have any decrease in their pulmonary function, and then would it recover in that two-hour window post-exposure. But what I'm going to talk about today, though, more about is our approach to exposure assessment for secondhand tobacco smoke. So tobacco smoke is, there's not any one thing you can really just measure to get a sense of it. It's a very complex aerosol. The latest number, there's well over 7,000 different compounds that have been measured in tobacco smoke. There's, you know, VOCs, semi-VOCs, fine particulate matter. And just for reference, you know, a single cigarette can put out about 7 to 23 milligrams of particulate matter if it's burned. So some past approaches to measuring secondhand tobacco smoke include measuring nicotine, and that's a great thing to measure because there isn't any other source of nicotine in the air. I mean, nicotine comes from burning tobacco, so it's a very specific source. You can look at some different VOCs. You can look at carbon monoxide and also find particulate matter. Some of the disadvantages of the other ones is that they're not, tobacco smoke's not the only source of them. We did chose to use as part of it particulate matter and fine particulate matter at PM2.5. So it's particulate matter 2.5 microns or less. And so a few of the reasons that we decided to do that I have listed here, it turns out it's a very sensitive marker of secondhand tobacco smoke. I'll show you some data on that in a minute. One great advantage, you can use direct reading instruments. So the gold standard, if you will, of measuring particulate matter is that you do a gravimetric method where you run air through a filter, you pre-weigh the filter, you post-weigh the filter, and you look at the difference in mass over time compared to the volume of air that you drew through the filter, and get your concentration. But that just gives you the average over a long time. You don't get any short-term variability information, and it's a little bit more difficult to do for short time periods because you have to have enough mass on the filter in order to be able to detect it. There are also health-based standards through the EPA Clean Air Act. Now, these aren't occupational standards. These are general environmental standards, but the current annual average standard for PM2.5 is 12 micrograms per cubic meter, and the 24-hour average is 35. So that kind of gives us a sense to compare with, although that's ambient air and we're measuring indoor air, but it kind of gives you a framework to look at. This is just an example from the past study that I mentioned. Look at the sensitivity of measuring PM2.5 with the direct reading instrument. So if you start out, this is in outdoors, you go in a bar and you can see the immediate jump in the peak and repeatedly. So that's a really sensitive indicator. And this is another, it just happened, one of our other studies, we sent somebody in an establishment to do some measurements and there was nobody smoking, but she stuck it out like she was supposed to. And then all of a sudden, somebody did eventually light a cigarette, and you can see, and she made a nice note of it in the log, and you can see how it really picked up that PM from that lit cigarette. Carbon monoxide is something we wanted to look at as well, and this is some data from a past study looking at pairing up carbon monoxide and PM2.5, and they match up pretty well, as you can see from this from these data here, although there are obviously other sources of carbon monoxide than just from burning tobacco. One of the reasons that we wanted to include the measurement of carbon monoxide is that, so if you put everybody in an environment, and I mean everybody's got different rates of breathing, and so their actual individual exposures are going to end up being different. And we wanted to come up with a way, so how can you pick up on that variability in an easy to implement method that's not too invasive and that has an opportunity to pick up a short-term change. So we decided to measure exhaled breath carbon monoxide. We also measured both personal PM2.5 in the breathing zone and carbon monoxide. And we had area samples in the bar. So we had one single stationary sampler in the bar, and everybody wore their own samplers for both carbon monoxide and PM2.5. And we also measured that, in our smoke-free area, in our kind of our baseline testing area, and in our follow-up area after it was done. And we also measured just temperature and relative humidity. The method, the instruments that we used for PM2.5, we used a TSI SideVac AM510. And if you have, start to get above about 70% humidity, the response of it as it becomes less linear, so we wanted to make sure that our humidity measurements were staying within the correct range. For carbon monoxide, for the personal and area samples, we used the Lascar USB CO data logger, and exhale breath, used the Care Fusion breath analyzer, and for temperature and relative humidity, used the Hobo data loggers. Now, as it turned out, we had some difficulty with the exhaled breath CO measurements. We were getting, there are these products on the market that they will report the concentration of exhaled carbon monoxide, but it's one of the ways you can screen for smoking status. So if somebody says they're a smoker or a non-smoker, you can look at their exhaled breath carbon monoxide and kind of get a sense of that. But we were getting readings on our instrument that were showing very high levels of exhaled breath CO and associated carboxyhemoglobin in people who we knew hadn't been exposed to CO. So I was at another meeting in Mobile, and we FedExed the instrument back to the manufacturer, and they put a new sensor in and said it was working fine, but it kept malfunctioning. So I don't have a lot of confidence in those data, so I'm not going to be able to present those data today. But I am going to present a bunch of data on the PM measurements in our different environments. And there's a lot of data here. I'll kind of walk you through this slide a little bit. So this gives you, on each testing day, there was 14 testing days, and the N here is the number of people that were being measured on that day. So every person wore a side pack with the tubing up to their collar. And they also, we also have rigged up a way to the little USB carbon monoxide data logs to measure personal CO, personal PM2.5, area CO, area PM2.5, and then also in the lab as well. But this is just the PM2.5 data here. So this gives the this is the mean level of particulate matter in the seven individuals on January 21st, the standard deviation. And then the area sample was the single fixed monitoring location in the bar. And then the lab measurement here, that's our smoke-free environment. And then the ambient number here on the far right is data that we pulled from the nearest EPA, National Ambient Air Quality Monitoring Station in New Orleans, and on that day. So that's the mean level on that day. So one of the things I want to point out, and I have a graph to show you in a little bit, but typically in occupational monitoring, industrial hygiene, you typically see that personal exposure measurements tend to be higher than the area exposure measurements. And the reason is that, well, obviously workers are usually near the sources of exposure, or their activities are actually creating the pollution that we're measuring. So it's a really important strategy for occupational monitoring to measure, take personal samples, and not just say we're going to use an area sample to estimate personal level exposure, although sometimes, some monitoring is better than none. So you usually see that the personal levels are higher than the area levels. As it turned out, as you can see here, if you look your way down, you'll see that in all cases but one, the area PM2.5 was higher than the personal. But when you think about it a little bit, this isn't a traditional. This isn't an occupational monitoring study. We weren't measuring workers. We were measuring customers in the bar. So and also possibly the location. When you're going to set up, if any of you have ever done area monitoring for environmental pollution, you can't just pick your area and say, I'm going to do it right here. There's other factors. Do you have power? Is it secure? Is it safe? Is somebody going to monkey with it, et cetera? So the area that we ended up choosing to measure it in as far was behind the counter at the bar, and where you might imagine more customers congregate over there. We didn't have any evidence where we had people keeping track of how many people were in different locations during different times, how many were smoking or not. But I would suggest that probably there were more smokers in that general area than were around the people who we were measuring around the bar. But for the lab, our smoke-free area and our outdoor air, those levels were roughly comparable. I've got it. This is just a graphic illustrating that fact. I mentioned that our personal measurements, in almost all cases but one, were lower than the area measurements, which isn't what you would typically see in an occupational setting. And then this gives just a summary data from all the different areas. So we had a total of 95 personal samples. So each person spent 3 hours in that environment. So each of those 95 data points includes about 3 hours of exposure monitoring data. And then the area and the lab data was for the duration of the day in which they were testing. We did have a couple days we had problems with the instrument for the area monitoring. That's why there's two extra lab days compared to area days. But you can see, so our mean area is 140.3. That's our standard deviation. Then the minimum to maximum range I have listed here, and then the interquartile range on the right. So to sum it up, so the area concentrations were higher than the personal concentration. The lab and ambient were roughly similar. So in terms of when you look at, typically when you want to measure pollution in an occupational environment, you want to relate it to a standard if you can. And I intentionally left this slide blank because there aren't any secondhand tobacco smoke occupational standards. To this day, there aren't even. OSHA's perspective is that, you know, they tend to look at individual compounds. They don't usually, and there's all sorts of other problems with OSHA's approach at establishing exposure limits. So there aren't any exposure standards. But one useful way of looking at it, and I'm not the person who thought of this, but if you think about the EPA does have some really detailed data supporting their air quality numbers. And for PM2.5, the air quality index, if you look here, this column here gives you the concentration of PM2.5 rather associated with different air quality levels. So if you see the weather page or on the news, sometimes they'll talk about this as it's typically ozone that you hear about on the news, ozone, but they also have these indices for PM2.5. And so our ranges were in the unhealthy range. You know, both the personal and area measurements were in this unhealthy range. Now, granted, the EPA's numbers are meant, you know, not just for a three-hour window, but coming back to me, as an industrial hygienist, I mean, I'm not really as concerned about customers in these environments because they can come and go as they please. But the workers really don't have that choice. And so we did observe a substantial amount of variability in personal PM2.5 within the same environment, and I think that illustrates the importance, nothing new here, that it's really important to take personal measurements when you can and not just say we're going to substitute an area measure for a personal exposure measurement. And as I stated before, the area measures were consistently higher and the ambient and lab PM2.5 were pretty similar. So perhaps, you know, the approach of using central monitoring station data as a substitute for cases when you don't have any other data that could be appropriate. Now, I don't know if you've seen, there's been a lot of stuff in the news recently, a smoke-free week in New Orleans, and they're slated, later on this week, the city council is slated to propose to make the bars and casinos smoke-free in New Orleans. And one other thing I wanted to point out, and this was, I was talking to somebody about this issue recently, and it had just come out in the news that, you know, the second largest tobacco company in the United States, I don't know if it's the second largest in the world, just announced that they're going to be making their offices smoke-free. And so when you talk about, should bars or casinos be smoke-free, it's like, I don't know what else to say. I say, well, why don't you talk to Reynolds Tobacco and see what they think for their employees? And this is a direct quote from the Washington Post article about it. I'm just going to read it out. I think it's remarkable. You know, if you can't imagine something like this coming out of the mouth of a spokesman for a tobacco company 10 years ago, say. So obviously, indoor smoking restrictions are the norm today. Most people expect a smoke-free work environment. We're simply aligning our tobacco use policies with the realities of what you're seeing in the general public today. And so they're gradually implementing that moving forward. And I'd like to conclude by acknowledging the many study participants and the research staff and volunteers who helped out on this project. It was a very large team effort, and it took a lot of work. And the support for the study was provided by the Louisiana Public Health Institute, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living, and the LSU School of Public Health, and the Stanley Scott Cancer Center. And I don't know if we have time for questions or.
No, 2 seconds.
Oh, I didn't even see that. How about that? Are there any questions from you right now before we move on to the next speaker? Please. As it turns out, the bar that we use was already interested in going smoke-free, so they started to have the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living had been sponsoring smoke-free Mondays at this location already, so we kind of had a working relationship, some of the other team members, so they were actually all about it, and they've actually decided to go completely smoke-free.
Mm-hmm.
No. No, all our study participants were non-smokers, and the time window that they spent in the bar was 3 hours, roughly. I mean, it was, you know, some people were 3 hours and 15 minutes or so, but that was our goal. We had, you know, logistically had to move people back and forth, so that's...